Okay, I'm here now at Microsoft Research with David Stern and Jörgen Ramgahl, and we're going to be talking about their use of F-sharp on a project that they're currently working on. So David and Jörgen, could you say a few words about the group you work with at, or work in at Microsoft Research and its area of focus at the moment?
So the lab that we're working is called Fuse Labs UK. So Fuse stands for Future Social Experiences, and essentially it's a group of people in Redmond, Boston, and here in the UK, where we're developing sort of new technologies around social experiences, social networks, etc. And sort of the focus for the group here in the UK really is everything that's to do with sort of machine learning and data mining. So how can we sort of use intelligence to sort of extract things from data and use that for social experiences.
Fantastic. So you guys have been working on a project called Project Emporia. Perhaps you could say a few words about what Project Emporia is and what it's aiming to achieve.
Sure. So Project Emporia is about filtering down the massive amount of content that's in the real-time web in social media. So people, you know, who would be overwhelmed by the amount of stuff coming in can actually really focus on the cream, the stuff they're really interested in.
Right. And we're talking about Twitter here, blogs.
So initially we're focusing on Twitter, right. But later we're going to branch out to other areas such as blogs and Facebook.
Fantastic.
So the sort of motivation for Emporia is that while there's maybe like 60 million tweets every day on Twitter, actually most of the users don't post very many tweets.
Right.
They mainly are interested in reading. So we targeted Emporia very much at people who are more interested in consuming rather than producing content.
Okay. Now, as I understand it, F-sharp has played a key role in the development of Project Emporia. Could you say a few words about how F-sharp has been used and how it's enabled you to get to where you are today?
I think the starting point for us really is, this sort of exploration phase, data exploration phase. So generally when we sort of tackle this new problem or new project, then there's this sort of, you know, pipeline of getting the data, exploring the data, and these things change. I mean, the things we're looking for change fast. We have to do data manipulation very easily. Very often it's in string and text manipulation, those kinds of things. So there's a whole sort of, this whole exploration phase is something where something like F-sharp has really enabled us quite a bit. For example, I mean, the F-sharp interactive mode where you can sort of, you know, change things on the fly and that happens. Those are sort of things that we use in the very early stages of a project. And I guess as these projects mature, then we start using F-sharp more to build sort of library components or things, you know, small components that could be reused later on. Generally, we use those F-sharp components in a bigger system. I don't know, maybe you can say more about how it's done for Emporia exactly.
Yeah, so I think that's all absolutely right. It's very important in the exploration phase. But also as the model becomes more mature, as we start to actually put components into Project Emporia, an advantage that F-sharp has is compositionality. Okay. So you can drop in different functions like that perform particular purposes in the model and swap them out on the fly. So even though Project Emporia is now publicly released, it's still an experimental thing. Right. So we're still changing things all the time, and this compositionality makes it easier to play around.
Absolutely, and as you've gone, you've built up this library of functions that you can then put together in this compositional fashion, as you mentioned, and potentially even let users build up interesting levels of composition in terms of what the data is telling them going forward.
Yes. Yep.
Okay. Excellent. So David, you've drawn up a quick back-of-the-envelope architecture of Project Emporia. Can you talk us through the key components very briefly?
Sure. So the front end of Project Emporia is a Silverlight client, which is what you see.
Yeah.
And that communicates with a query service at the back end that provides the filtered content from the social feed from Twitter.
So this is taking the feed from Twitter and filtering it right down to something manageable for the UI.
That's right. And actually, there's a component I missed off here, which is called Twig. which is what processes the Twitter firehose and feeds it into the system.
Right. And you've also got a couple of little boxes with M written on there. Can you say a little bit about what those are?
So that's Matchbox, which is the recommendation system, which actually predicts whether a particular tweet will be interesting to you. And that's actually the part that's written in F#.
Okay. So one of the things that's really interesting to me is understanding that F# doesn't have to be the entire solution. We've got Silverlight as a front end because it's appropriate for that to be the case. You know, we've got databases on here, we've got other engines, but actually it makes sense for you to use F# in some areas. And is it possible to expand at all on why F# was actually really good for the Matchbox filtering component as opposed to perhaps some other languages that you could have chosen?
Yeah. So F# was particularly appropriate for the Matchbox part for several reasons, I guess, that we covered already, but it's very good for expressing data analysis, for initially sort of developing the model and prototyping the model. Mm-hmm. But then it also gives you the compositionality you need to later on have flexibility to try out different components in the model. But the simplest way of using Matchbox, and so this system runs in Windows Azure, and the simplest way of using the model at the moment was to write some of these components in C# and then reference a Matchbox library that was written in F# rather than writing the whole thing in F#.
Right. And these would be running in worker processes in Azure, or
These are a mixture. So these are web role services, and this is a worker.
Okay. So you've got a mixture there with an F# library being referenced from other C# components, all running in Azure, delivering the architecture that is Project Emporia.
That's right.
So you know, I've also heard that F# is extremely good at working with data. Can you say a few words about how you've used F# to manipulate data in Project Emporia?
Right. So, a lot of the sort of machine learning components like Matchbox, a lot of the work it does behind the scenes, sort of heavy-duty number crunching. One of the nice things about F# is that it's sort of very well tailored to this sort of type of computation. And hence it also makes sense for us to keep these components in F# because it's sort of much better suited to this type of work than some of the other languages.
And obviously you've got a database there as well. So is there any guidance you can give in terms of, do you use a database to do a lot of the core data manipulation, or do you use an F# library to use a lot of the core manipulation? You know, is it a temporal manipulation that's particularly good with F#? You know, what are your thinking in terms of do I go database or do I go F# libraries when manipulating data?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think a lot of the sort of run-off-the-mill type of computations can be done in the database, but I think, I don't know if you'd agree with that, but I think one big issue for these, this is an online system, right? So one of the big issues of these things is that everything has to be fast, everything has to happen in real time, and so we don't want to overburden the database with a lot of computation. So essentially what we do is really pull in the data, small chunks of data into the F# components, and I think there do the number crunching that needs to be done, and then feed it back to some of the front end.
Right. And clearly that's going to map extremely well onto doing that in Azure, for example, and you've got the parallelism inherent in F#, and you've obviously got the scalability of Azure, so that sounds like a really good match. And is scalability a key aspect of the Azure side of this?
Yeah, I think absolutely, and I think actually one of the big things about the great things about F# is that F# sort of puts you in a mode of programming that's very different. This functional mode of programming that's very different from anything that we've sort of done in the past. And one of the key ideas, sort of this notion of statelessness, of not mutating state, and that's incredibly powerful for an online system, right? Because the F# components, we don't want them to sort of keep state across time. We want every time that a person talks to the system, the system does some computation, gives a result back, and it's ready for the next piece. So this idea of having a stateless component written in F sharp is very natural, and obviously that then fits well in what you can do with it.
Fantastic. Thank you very much, guys. Project Emporium. Hello, so I'm here with Anton Schweighofer, who works in the Microsoft Research Ad Center team. Anton, do you want to introduce a little bit about the work that you've been doing recently?
All right. Sure. So I'm working for Ad Center, and Ad Center is one of the two big teams that contribute results to what you see if you go to Bing.com. So the core search team provides all this content here. And the Ad Center team clearly is dealing with showing what is here in the ads block, on the top of the page and on the right-hand side of the page. My specific project is concerned with monitoring the whole, what we call the advertising ecosystem. So clearly, for advertising, we have like three key parties. First one is the user who goes to Bing.com and wants something. On the other hand, we have the advertisers who would like to have ads for their products shown here in the advertising regions. And then we have the whole platform that provides the service, so Bing itself in a way. And in my work, I'm dealing with economic models that monitor the health of the overall advertising ecosystem. So how well off are users? Do they get what they want from a Bing results page? How well off are advertisers? And how well off is Bing? So there are various complex trade-offs that are to be made when optimizing what you see on Bing as a whole, so on the whole results page. And this involves coding quite complex mathematical models often. So if you see the equations written down on paper or on a whiteboard, they would often fill the page pretty much. And my task is now to, understand that, code it up, make sure that it's correct, and then apply those models to data at the size of like a few terabytes or petabytes even.
So when you were thinking a little bit about which coding language you can use to code up these economic algorithms, did you have a short list of languages? What was your thought process to take you through to what ultimately was a choice of F-sharp?
Mm-hmm. I've been for many years coding in MATLAB, which also allows you to express mathematical algorithms in a very concise way. But what we are dealing with here has often a much higher complexity of compared to what I was working with before. So I think the F-sharp's killer feature for me in that context was units of measure that effectively give you a form of type system for real valued numbers or for integers. So any kind of numbers that you store. For example, these numbers could represent probabilities. Like, in that case, what's your probability of clicking on that ad if you see that page? So, in a traditional language, you would just say, okay, that's a double. Yeah, fair enough. Yeah. But there's a notion attached to that double. And in that case, it is the probability of a click given that you saw that ad. Other probabilities could be, okay, like once you've clicked on that ad, what's the probability that you spend more than, let's say, half a minute looking at what you can see afterwards? And again, that's a different probability. What F-sharp allows you with units of measure is to avoid mixing those probabilities when it's not appropriate. So a probability of an ad click, given that you see that ad, is a different kind of beast from the probability of you actually staying there and maybe finding what you wanted on the landing page.
So presumably when you describe these algorithms in code, the fact that you are not having to spend so much effort in your code disambiguating your different units of measure, it actually makes the code much more readable, much more concise, and gives you the type checking, if we could use that word, of the measures being correct as well.
Correct. So the type checking is indeed the big advantage.
Right.
So having units of measure attached to pretty much each floating point number that I store saves me from having to write loads and loads of unit tests, for example. Because the compiler already tells me, hey, Anton, you're not supposed to add up apples and oranges.
Right. Yeah. So that presumably has saved you quite a lot of time. As you said, it actually saves you having to write a unit test because you've got that type-safe checking of those different units. That sounds like a real killer feature for one of the things you needed to consider.
It is, So it also gives you a bit of feedback then after you've actually also... may develop the mathematical algorithm for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And it also gives you this additional safety check on whether you've done the math correctly.
Right.
If the units of measure work out,
yeah.
as probably your physics teacher has
mm-hmm.
taught you,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
the units of measure work out, then you're already in the kind of good region.
Right. Excellent. So units of measure, a great example of how they can be used to speed up the implementation of some economic modeling as part of... AdSense for Bing.
Mm-hmm. The other important feature I would add here is the ease of doing parallel computing in F#.
And parallelism is something that we've touched on a few times. And can you say a few words about how F# makes that an easier process, or the fact that?
Well, F# encourages me to use immutable data structures.
Okay.
So when the multiple threads work on a specific problem, there is less risk of actually them running into deadlocking issues or something like that. So the code that I write would naturally be already immutable, so I can just spawn off a number of threads and have them do their thing, and I have to worry about less.
Right, so you don't have to go through the whole process of taking an existing set of code, making it stateless, because it's already immutable, and then actually parallelizing it. It's an easier process. No sort of single switch that you can flip to make it run in parallel, but actually it's already in a state that enables it to be parallelized much more easily.
Yeah, well, it's pretty close to just flipping a switch.
Okay.
So just before I came here, I did exactly that exercise.
Right.
I had a bit of code that ran on a single thread.
Yep.
And within adding 3-4 lines of code, I had it run on all of my CPU cores.
Fantastic. So parallelism, units of measure, a couple of features of the language that's really helped you in this particular project.
Indeed. So F# has helped me a lot, and I think if I didn't have F# at my disposal, the whole development time would have been by a factor of 2, 3, 4, something like that.
So significantly longer without those key features.
Yeah.
Anton, thank you very much for your time. Hi, so I'm here now with Tor Glapel. Tor works in Microsoft Research in the Online Services and Advertising Group. Tor, can you tell us a little bit about the work you've been doing with App Predictor specifically, and what your group covers, and then a little bit more about how F# has enabled your team and yourself to actually do the great work that you've done with App Predictor.
Absolutely. So in the Online Services and Advertising Group, we're doing research on all aspects of the web, search, advertising, all of these exciting topics, typically covering huge scales of data, lots of users, so it's a very interesting area. And we're using F# pretty much throughout for a number of tasks, like the universal tool that we're using. And so one project that we've recently almost completed, in a sense, is Ad Predictor.
Okay.
And Ad Predictor fulfills a key role in Bing and in selecting the ads that are shown for a given search.
So this piece here. Right?
So that's this piece here, and also these pieces here. Right? And basically what happens, a user enters a query, in this case Kinect, and then of course the search engine needs to decide what ads will be shown. These are the kind of organic results, and we also want to show some ads. Now which ads get shown, that's the key question.
Yeah.
And of course we want to have a great user experience, so we want ads that people actually click on. And also the advertisers of course pay money for having their ads displayed, and that's how much they're willing to pay is also a great indicator of how good
right.
the ad is.
Right.
And so we need to estimate for a given user and a given search query and a given ad, how likely is it that the user is going to click on it?
Okay.
And that's what Ad Predictor does.
Okay.
And there's actually a nice story about how this came about, because we first hit upon this problem when Ad Center organized a competition, the
okay.
Ad Predict competition.
Okay.
And they knew they needed to address this problem for the search engine,
mm-hmm.
and they thought best thing would be organize a competition, give people some nice incentives, in
yeah.
this case a trip to Hawaii if they
right.
win the competition.
Okay.
And so our team participated in this, and
yeah.
we actually did come first, shared first place
wow.
with another team from Redmond.
Okay.
And we were using F# throughout, so it was our hero tool, and we ended up taking
yeah.
the F# version from back then to Hawaii and celebrated.
That's a great story, and I'd love to drill in a little bit more to how F# enabled you to actually win that competition. What was its key features that enabled you to actually deliver the great piece of work you've done around Ad Predictor and actually take that first prize?
Right, so the first thing in such a problem is actually a machine learning problem, right? You're trying to learn from past data what's going to happen in the
mm-hmm.
future. So you need to go through past data, and we're talking gigabytes
of data.
Yeah. And so F# is a great tool to, you know, go through those log files, import them into SQL in a very structured way, and doing ad hoc analysis. You know, there's the F# interactive.
Yeah.
So you don't always have to compile all your code. You
right.
can just do
you
it step by step
yeah.
and
yeah.
explore.
Yeah.
And that's why it's called exploratory data analysis.
Right.
That's
okay.
that's really
okay.
what it enables here.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
so discovering what it actually is that decides that, or that helps us predict on which ad the user is going
mm-hmm.
to click. Is it the text here? Is it the font? Is it the link?
Mm-hmm.
Is it something to do with the user or something to do with the query? All of these things need to be explored, and we did that exploration
okay.
basically with F# in combination yeah. with SQL, obviously.
Okay, so what, I'm interested in the split between how you use SQL as a way of storing and running sort of set-based queries on your data versus how you use F# to actually start looking at interrogating and manipulating that data. Is there kind of an obvious split between what do you use SQL for and what you used F# for?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the first big step is to get the data into the SQL database.
Okay.
And log files are often messy, you know, it's many fields, some of them you may not even be able to fully interpret.
Right.
So the first thing is you run F# over this, write
okay.
a parser, which
okay.
is something that F# is particularly suitable for.
Okay.
Create an internal data structure
right.
within F#,
right.
and then have almost a SQL compiler, if you like,
yep.
that gets you that data structure
yep.
mapped into
yep.
the SQL database. And from then on, you have that parity of your internal data structure and the database schema, and that was something that
right.
worked very
right.
well for
right.
us. Then we did a lot of analysis within SQL, even using Excel, actually, you
yep.
know, to visualize stuff. And then, of course, for the learning algorithms, we needed fast language. Again,
right.
the learning algorithms are complex mathematical functions, so we could succinctly express them in F#. But also, we weren't losing performance. Like previously, we used MATLAB and things like that a lot, but it just doesn't work if you're dealing with billions of training
okay,
examples, which is what we're trying
yeah.
to do here.
Yeah. So that the algorithms were already reasonably understood, but actually F# enabled you to succinctly express those in code in a very performant way as well.
Exactly, and being relatively sure that they are correct,
right?
Because if code is so comes in big chunks,
yeah.
it's always so hard to read, so
yeah.
correctness is harder
yeah.
to
yeah.
make sure of. But if you have a succinct formulation, you know,
yeah.
then you can check every single line, and that compact representation really helps a lot, in particular for people who want to do complex mathematical stuff,
indeed,
for example.
Indeed. And you've got all the nice typing features of the language as well, so the strong typing, you know, is going to mean that you're going to capture some of those errors that are left behind, even when you've got a very concise, succinct representation of your algorithm.
Absolutely, and I mean the functional aspect, the fact that functions are first-class citizens of the
yeah.
language
yeah.
and have this great composability
yeah.
is really helpful. Here's an example. We need to extract that information of of what particular features help us predict how good an ad is.
Yeah.
And these are functions of this very complex whole page, in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And you want to be able to compose them and take them apart and express them succinctly. And so that's how we use the functions in F-Sharp.
Fantastic. So, composability, the ability to massage and manipulate data for your analysis, to explore the code and explore the algorithms on the data set, have all been absolutely great features of F-Sharp that enabled you to win the competition for Ad Predictor.
That's
and
right, yeah.
Get your code actually running on this site. So, thanks very much, Tor.
Good, thanks.
Hello. So, I'm now going to talk to Joaquin Quinonero Candela, who is a researcher here at Microsoft Research Cambridge. And Joaquin has been spending some time looking at some games programming. And we're going to, again, consider how F-Sharp has been used to develop a key component of that game. So, Joaquin, could you say a little bit more about your group and then go on to talk a little bit more about what you've been working on lately?
Oh, absolutely, yes. I have been here at Microsoft Research in Cambridge for a bit more than 3 years now. Initially part of a group that used to call itself Applied Games Group, so we used to do a lot more of games-related stuff like TrueScale came out of that group. And then lately, actually today, officially, I'm a dev lead with Ad Center. So I develop algorithms to decide what ads we show on Bing and stuff like that. But I've kept a little bit of a passion for games. I'm a passionate player on the one hand. And so we've kept a tight contact with that. And so what I'm going to show you is a game that we're finishing. It's actually just been submitted to certification, again, for the Xbox 360. It's going to be an Xbox Live Arcade game.
Okay. And do you have an example running that you can show us?
I have an example running. It's one of the latest builds.
Fantastic.
That may or may not pass certification. We'll see about that.
Yep.
Okay. So I'm just going to launch the game. The game of Go, I don't know whether you play Go, Dave.
I haven't played Go. I'm familiar with the game, but I'm not a Go gamer.
Right. So it's a pretty simple board game where two players place stones on a grid.
Okay.
All stones are the same, and there's a bunch of very basic rules. Actually, it takes a couple of minutes to really understand the basic rules.
Okay.
But the interesting thing about Go is just the sheer complexity of the game. And it's still a challenge for AI designers.
And it's more complex than chess, right?
It is way more complex than chess, yes, indeed.
Okay.
In fact, the strongest chess player today is a computer.
Right. Okay.
But the strongest Go players are still humans.
Right. Okay.
So let me walk you through the game. So this is how it looks like when you launch it. You have this beautiful temple.
Yeah.
And now there's essentially three ways you can play the game. You can either play a story mode, which is sort of the usual campaign mode that you play as a single player in your box. And then you can play local games either against the AI, and actually we'll be talking more about the AI later, and David Stern, who is here with us, actually wrote the AI in F-Sharp. He's going to tell us a lot more about how that went.
Okay.
And then finally, of course, there's the inevitable Xbox Live, so you can play either ranked games or just friendly matches. I'd like to show you a little bit story mode, because our assumption is that most Xbox 360 owners have actually never heard of the game of Go before.
Mm-hmm.
So we thought we really have to put a very big effort in trying to
attract people.
And then, of course, what we didn't want to do is we didn't want to give just a dry, boring tutorial, right?
Okay.
So we wanted to just allow people to just start playing immediately, right?
Right.
So what you see here, this sort of a shiny breadcrumb path, is the progress that you need to make as you make your way through this adventure all the way to the top of the mountain. And there's a whole story behind it.
Okay, this is the path of Go.
And that is exactly the path of Go, yes.
Right.
And you can sort of see the way we've done it a little bit like a graphic adventure. You arrive at an old temple, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, this is you, and there's a grandmaster. Okay. One of the cool things is that your own avatar is integrated in the game.
Mm-hmm.
So you play with your avatar all the way through, which is kind of nice.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so this is basically the way it looks. Then we have, as you go during the game, you get small hints. You have a small basic tutorial. This would be a a very small Go board, a 9x9.
Yep.
Normally, Go games are played on a 19x19 board.
Okay,
a
so
lot
it's
longer.
A training game. Yeah,
yes,
yeah.
But it's actually a lot of fun to play on 9x9, and if you're
okay.
a beginner, this is a very good size.
Right.
So I'm going to exit the basic tutorial. In the story, there's two kinds of things you can do. One of them is just solve basic puzzles. So this is an example of a puzzle that you could solve. So
okay.
let's just solve. This illustrates storm capture.
Yeah.
And then the other thing is you can actually play games against the master. And this is where the AI kicks in for the first time.
Okay.
So throughout the story, you are playing against the grandmaster. And the difficulty, of course, increases as you go.
Right.
So what I'm going to show to you now is the first scene. The game has five full 3D scenes.
Okay.
And this is the temple. This is where you start. You're playing
okay.
against the master.
Mm.
And you can sort of see it's a pretty cool
3D
environment. We also figured
yeah.
Xbox 360 owners don't really want to play sort of a flat 2D game,
right?
Even if
right,
this
right.
is a board game.
Right? Right.
And you know, and of course I can actually play Go on it.
Yeah.
One cool thing that that we also did is because people might be a little bit clueless in the beginning,
yep.
You can see that here you have the possibility
to
invoke
yeah.
suggest
yeah.
move. And
okay.
what you have is you have a second instance of the AI, slightly stronger,
okay.
that actually plays for you. So you can sort of
okay.
see, now I could follow this suggestion, which is actually a pretty good move,
okay.
And just follow that. And then another thing that I'm going to show to you in a second, let me just place one more stone and then it'll be meaningful.
Yeah.
Go is really about controlling territory.
Okay.
And you don't need to fill the board with stones. You need to define solid boundaries. And if you're starting to play, you might not know that in this case, you actually are very likely to already control all this territory.
Okay.
So we have what we call territory prediction in there as well.
Okay, so this is one of the other scenes in Go?
This is the second scene, yes. Alert, spoilers, right? You're playing against a fairy lady here,
right.
And we have a full 3D fish down there.
Yeah, brilliant. That's a nice water effects as well.
Yes,
yeah.
No, the water effects are pretty cool. I should also say, you know, to give credit to the XNA team, this is one of the few Xbox Live Arcade games that have been fully written using XNA.
Right.
And in fact, it's been there's a guy called Marcus Joost, who is
okay.
pretty much the dev who has written the whole game
right,
single-handed, except for the AI bit.
Wow. So that really shows the power of XNA now
it absolutely
a serious framework.
It absolutely
yeah,
does,
yeah.
yes, yes. And in a record time, so he had a first very solid version of the game in less than a year.
Wow.
And then all the rest, you know how it is integration and complying with...
Right, yeah, exactly. The pieces that actually just take quite a long time.
Exactly, exactly, yes.
Yeah. Engineering.
Yes, absolutely. So let me... show you once you cross the lake, there's sort of a bunch of other scenes that you go through. So one interesting thing is that to understand a little bit the reason why Go is such a complex game, the thing is that if you were to enumerate the number of possible games of Go that you can play, this by far exceeds the number of atoms in the universe.
Okay.
So you can sort of see that if you wanted to write a program that, in a brute force way, explores
right.
a game tree,
right. this is not
you're not going anywhere.
Yeah, exactly.
And I'll let David tell us in a moment about the details of the cool algorithm for the AI.
Fantastic.
So this is a bridge, a hanging bridge, and you can sort of see that the next step is going to take you
out there
to the cave. If we were to pump up the volume, you'd hear very nice wind effects.
Okay.
There's birds.
Excellent.
There's all kinds of things. Also, the noise that the stones make is different on every
every
material.
Surface.
Of course, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So when you reach the cave, the fourth level is actually a cave. You end up meeting someone. I will not tell you what happens exactly. You can sort of see that person looks a lot like you, and it has to do with the whole story. There's a big drama, there's a big mystery, a little bit inspired a little bit by
right.
Star Wars, where you have a twin that you didn't know about that you have to find. Anyway, so what we have here is we have a cave, and this cave contains a secret path To the top of the mountain. There's a little staircase there in the back that you have to sort of go through, and that you can only unlock under a special number of conditions that I will not tell you about.
Okay.
And so this is the final scene. It's my favorite. It's the one at the top of the mountain where you play on a massive golden board.
Wow.
And if you win in a special way, then you unlock a secret that's hidden inside the golden board.
Okay.
And so this is the golden board. Here we have our nice favorite golden dragon as well. You're playing the Grandmaster. You meet again. You know,
right?
It's one of those stories. A nice sort of starry night. You can sort of see the star reflected on the board.
Yeah, some lovely specularity there.
And at this stage, the AI actually gets pretty strong, and people will have to practice seriously. So one interesting thing about this AI is that the challenge is to have a strong Go AI that runs on a 5-year-old computer that was not designed
of course.
To do heavy mathematical simulations.
Absolutely. Here and I'd like to now introduce David Stern, who is actually the creator of the AI for the Path of Go. David, we're seeing the game be played here with a human and an AI, and you've been working on the Path of Go for some time now. Can you tell us a little bit about how hard this problem is to crack?
Sure. So the complexity of Go, as Joaquin explained, is much higher than chess. So the world's strongest chess player is a computer, but the world's strongest Go player is still a human. And the reason for that is because in Go there's many more legal moves you can play each turn. Mm-hmm. So the tree of possible future games that you have to explore in order to play well is much bigger.
Right.
And the other problem is that in order to evaluate a Go position is much harder than chess. Mm-hmm. So in chess, you know, different pieces have different inherent values. So mm-hmm. like a knight is worth a certain number of points, a queen has a higher value than a rook, and so on.
Yes.
But in Go, all of the pieces that each player has are these stones, and they're all mm-hmm. identical.
Mm-hmm.
So the reason that this stone has maybe more value than this stone is just mm-hmm. because of the connections with other stones around it.
So
for a computer to understand that, it's much more complex. It takes much more computation.
Indeed. And you've actually managed to put together an AI that is one of the best AIs around for Go, but also runs on an Xbox as well. So presumably that means that it has to be a relatively compact, very efficient piece of code that doesn't rely on vast numbers of computations. And can you tell us a little bit about, in non-technical terms, how you've been able to do that, and how F-Sharp has enabled you to put together this particular AI and perform as well as it does on an Xbox?
Yeah. So the AI has two main components. One is a Monte Carlo search algorithm, which is kind of like an algorithm which searches through possible future games in order to choose where to move.
Right.
But it's very, very selective in which games it
okay.
explores.
Okay.
And the other component is a pattern system,
okay.
Which came out of some research that we did at MSR. And that's a system which is trained from hundreds of thousands of historical expert human games.
Right.
And it learns to predict the moves that a human expert would make, and it uses that to prune the game tree, so reduce the number of moves that the search system has to explore in order to decide where to move. So this is actually a useful example here. So what Joaquin has done is he's shown the predicted... this game is pretty much finished, but it shows who owns which
right,
part of
the
board
yeah,
at the end
yeah,
of the game.
Yeah.
And what the Monte Carlo search is doing is it's from a given mid-game position, it's playing forward until the very end of the game, until you get a position like this. And at that point, for every point, it knows whether it's owned by white or black. So it gets a sample of who would have won that game and
right.
who would have lost that game.
Right.
And by
right.
gathering thousands of samples mm-hmm. like this, it can decide which moves are more valuable to play. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you've got two components to your AI engine: the learned component and the predictive component as well. That's doing the Monte Carlo simulation. How have you managed to use F-sharp in order to solve the problem of the path of Go requiring so many calculations to actually make a sensible decision. And I'd be really interested to understand your decision process of, you know, should you use F-sharp or should you use another language? What led you to use F-sharp in this process, and how it's benefited you in this solution?
So I think there's a number of reasons. Firstly, for Go in particular, F-sharp makes expressing lots of the things you have to do much more concise, much more elegant. So if you write C-sharp code, for example, for a Go AI, you would spend a lot of time writing for loops and that type of thing, iterating over the board, whereas in F-sharp, that type of operation can be written much more concisely. But more importantly, this is an experimental AI. It was developed over some period of experimentation, trying different components to see what worked well together. And during that experimentation process, being able to compose, for example, the functions which prune the search tree, be able to swap in and out different functions, which comes from the compositionality in F#, is very valuable.
Excellent.